to T. Rowe Price's Confident Conversations on Retirement. I'm Jessica Sclafani, and I'm excited to be your host this season. As a retirement strategist, I've spent years helping people make sense of retirement, both the numbers and the emotions behind them. Together with my colleagues, we'll explore practical insights to help you retire confidently. Today, we're exploring strategies to save for both short-term goals and long-term security. This may seem like a basic topic, but saving touches so many aspects of our financial lives. Whether it's buying a home in a few years or retiring decades from now, the right tools and habits can make saving both achievable and rewarding. Emphasis on the rewarding. Joining me are retirement strategist Rachel Wecker and certified financial planner professional Stuart Ritter. Welcome, Rachel and Stuart.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you. So let me start by saying that I was doing my homework last night to talk to both of you, the experts. I had to prepare a little bit, right? And this exercise led me to really reflect on, well, how do I feel about savings? And when I say the word savings, what does it bring up for me? And honestly, I was a little surprised. It was a mixed bag. Immediately, I found myself saying, well, oh my goodness, am I saving enough? Am I saving in the right types of accounts? How do I know if I'm saving enough? So I'm just curious, what does saving mean to both of you? Maybe it's not quite so tortured for both of you, but Rachel, I'll start with you.
No, I think those feelings are valid. And I think when I think about savings, I think it's different depending on what I'm saving for. So some things are really exciting and some things are intimidating, and that's probably a function of how much I'm going to need, mm-hmm. as well as how far away this goal is.
I think of it from a slightly different perspective. I don't think of any of it as savings. I think of all of it as spending. Hmm. I'm just not spending it all this month. So the money that being put aside for a down payment on a house, I'm spending that on the house. The money that's going into my retirement plan, I'm spending that on my retirement plan. So I see it as something I'm getting for all the money that I might not be spending this month.
Stuart, I can always count on you to reframe the topic. That's helpful. And I'm going to try to practice that, because that sounds more fun than me sitting at my desk last night wondering, oh my gosh, am I doing it right? The other thing that I was thinking about is, and I think I just have to say it, right? We're just going to acknowledge this head on. Many people feel like they have more financial priorities than they have money to cover those financial priorities, which makes it tricky to insert savings into that equation, right? So if that's our starting place for many people, how do we tackle savings?
I think the first thing that we need to do is acknowledge that even listening to this episode could feel overwhelming, because saving is complicated, it can be emotional, and it's often really intimidating. So it's no wonder that people sometimes just avoid the conversation. But we know that for people who will not only step into the conversation, but put together a financial plan, it can have a tremendous emotional benefit in addition to the financial impact. And in our experience, we see that when participants use a financial wellness program to create a plan, there is a significant improvement in the way they feel in their relationship towards money. Specifically, we saw a 30% reduction in individuals reporting that they felt scared and confused about their money after they put together a plan. And conversely, a 40% increase in those who reported feeling confident and secure. We know that their actual financial picture didn't immediately improve that dramatically, but it did have a dramatic impact on their emotional feelings towards money.
Way to bring the numbers, Rachel. I love that. A 30% reduction in folks feeling scared and confused, and a 40% increase in feeling confident and secure.
That's
exactly
right.
Those are meaningful,
mm-hmm.
really meaningful.
And we know that people need help. When we ask people if they felt they were saving enough for retirement, a full third of people said they knew that they weren't. They cited reasons like managing their day-to-day expenses and paying down existing debt as the reasons they weren't able to save as much as they knew they should for retirement. So it's not that people don't know that they're supposed to be saving more. It's that they really need help figuring out how.
I'm so glad that you shared that point, Rachel, because for so many people, savings isn't something that just happens, right? Even if we know it, we should be saving, and maybe we know we should be saving more, it can require some trade-offs.
That's exactly right.
That's right. This may seem like a simple topic, but there's so many layers to it. And it's deeply personal because you're touching on trade-offs between what you want to do now, enjoying life now, and what you want to do in the future and enjoying life in the future. And one of my favorite quotes is from Warren Buffett, who said, "Do not save what is left after spending. Instead, spend what is left after saving." And the point he's trying to make is to be deliberate about what you dedicate your money to. That's the saving part, the spending in the future part. And I can illustrate this with a story. I had the wonderful opportunity to teach a personal finance class at Johns Hopkins University. And I gave the students an assignment. And the assignment was to track their spending in just three categories. So I didn't want to overwhelm them, and a lot of people feel overwhelmed if they're supposed to write down every penny they spend on everything. So I said, track a couple of things. And one of the things they needed to track was spending on food outside their house. So if they bought groceries, that's one thing. And I had one student come back. They had to write an essay about what they experienced. One student came back and said, "I am buying something like 15 meals a week outside the house. I grab the coffee and the muffin on the way in, that's breakfast. And then I never make my lunch, so I buy lunch on the road. And then you know, it's social, so I go out for dinner Friday and Saturday nights, and a couple other nights during the week I'm too tired to cook. So I'm buying 15 meals outside the house every week. Simultaneously, I'm complaining about how I can't save up money for the spring break trip I want to take next semester. I think I might have found the issue." And I said, "Maybe you haven't, because if spending the money on the food is more important to you than spring break, then you're putting your money where you want it to go. But if you have a different priority, that's the trade-off we all struggle with. And if we don't sit down and get deliberate about what our priorities are, and understand how we spend our money, that's often what's creating that mismatch and making us feel poorly about it." But as we've talked about, as soon as he put a plan together, now he was feeling more confident about it. Making his own lunch wasn't a sacrifice. That was his ability to go on spring break.
What I'm hearing from you, Stuart, is just maybe being a little more mindful. And then to me, I think that would help with some of the guilt about spending a little bit too. So as I was listening to you now, I was thinking about the latte that I had this morning. And we all know the latte is more expensive than the coffee, right?
Yes.
So I had to really think, should I get this latte? Jessica, do you really need the $4 latte, right? I think we can all relate to that debate. I decided I did this morning. But some mornings I won't. I mean, I can't get that $4 latte every day. That is not what I want to be doing. But I said, yes, today I need it, and I can feel okay about it because I thought about it.
Right. It goes back to what Rachel was saying. If you've got a plan and you've said, you know what, buying coffee is a priority for me, a lot of that guilt can go away because you know it's part of your plan. You enjoy the coffee more, and you're in good shape.
And I'm not going to do it every day. So,
there you go.
Yeah, okay. Well, I didn't mean for us to go on such a deep tangent about coffee and latte, but I think it was helpful. Okay, Rachel, I'm going to come to you for this one. A phrase that I hear pretty often is financial goals. And to me, financial goals is all capital letters. It's very serious, and it sounds a little intimidating. So can you talk us through what financial goals are? And specifically, what makes financial goals different from a budget?
So everyday budgeting is basically managing your monthly expenses. So think about things like groceries, rent or mortgage, your utilities and insurance. as well as those things that you were spending for fun activities like going out with your friends or maybe pursuing hobbies, because those absolutely should be part of a healthy budget. By contrast, financial goals are bigger things that cost money beyond your routine spending. And each of these goals has three elements: what you want, when you want it, and how much it's going to cost. And knowing the when helps you determine both how much to save as well as the right way to invest these savings. And then the connection to that monthly budget is incremental. So you want to build these goals into your budget over time and shift your discretionary spending as necessary to make room for those savings. For this conversation, I would frame short-term goals as things that are 1 to 2 years out, medium-term goals as 3 to 5 years away, and long-term goals as 5 or more years away. So think about short-term goals. They often could include saving for a car, maybe a vacation, or even funding something with more emotional weight, like a wedding that might be 1 or 2 years away. If it's not already on your radar, building up an emergency savings account could likely be considered a short-term goal, and they are so important to help you make sure that you can continue to focus on your longer-term goals without getting derailed when life happens and some unexpected expense hits. Medium-term goals might be saving for a down payment on our house or possibly setting aside money for a child's early education needs. And these goals often have slightly more flexibility than short-term ones, but you still want to limit your risk while aiming for some growth as you think about the investments for these savings. And then finally, long-term goals are usually 5 or more years out. They could often include things like retirement or college savings. And with time on your side, you can take on more investment risk to pursue higher growth. So understanding your time frame is key because it's going to guide not only how much you need to save, but how you think about investing and where to do that.
One of the things to keep in mind is that your budget is often made up of things that you decided one time, not necessarily ongoing. For example, I'm going to talk about housing, because when you look at all age groups, whether you're 20 in your 20s, 40s, 60s, 80s, 30% of spending for every age group is on housing. And for a lot of people, they make that housing choice one time. So that is going to account for 30% of your budget. And transportation is 15% of spending. So the decisions you make in those two categories are about half your spending and dictate essentially the rest of your lifestyle today and how much you have available for spending in the future, what we've been calling savings. So make very deliberate decisions, especially in those two categories, because often sometimes the reason people don't have a lot of money left is because they've made some decisions that have used up all their money for their current budget, and understanding how to make those trade-offs can be helpful in putting the whole plan together.
That is helpful. And Rachel, I'll just say that I liked how you framed the what, when, and how of financial goals. To me, that could be a helpful way to just break it down and start to understand what my priorities are. So that was great. I think at this point, we'll shift gears. And now I'm going to bring up a word that I know not everyone wants to talk about, but put your seatbelts on, buckle up. Here we go. Debt. Question for both of you. Can I say paying off debt is a financial goal? And then another hard question, I think. How should people weigh paying off debt against other financial goals or priorities like saving for the future?
Well, first, yes, paying off debt is a financial goal. You've got a legal obligation to do that. So recognize that when you go into it.
Fair enough. Yes. Okay.
But first, as Rachel mentioned, you meet your financial legal obligation for whatever you currently owe on the debt. But as Rachel mentioned earlier, building an emergency fund helps you avoid going further into debt. And there's a phrase we use in our house: if you find yourself in a hole, stop digging.
Wise words.
So don't think you've got to put off saving completely. Don't think that you can't build the emergency fund. You're going to be doing these things as parallel priorities. You're going to be doing them at the same time. And that's where the savings hierarchy helps. Cover an emergency fund. Put that near the top of your list. Capture any employer match in your employer's retirement plan, because that's free money. And then start focusing on paying off high interest debt faster than you're necessarily legally obligated to do so. So that gives you probably the next best return on your money. If I can, you know, put on my CFP hat for just a second, if I have credit card debt and I'm paying 20% on that, every dollar I put towards that has essentially a 20% return. So debt is really just another expense you have to manage. When you took on that debt, what you were doing is spending your own future money. So your past self decided that your current self was going to spend money on whatever your past self bought, which is something to think about, because if your current self wants to take on debt, remember what you're doing is obligating your future self to not spend all their money on what they want. They're helping to fund what you want today. That's what debt is. Now, it's also important to understand, especially since I mentioned credit cards, not everybody has credit card debt. As a matter of fact, more than half of people don't. Over half of American families pay their credit card bills in full each month, and this has been the case for years. So if you do have balances, first recognize that you're actually in the minority, and second, start thinking about how you're allocating your money. If you want to pay that off faster, make that one of your financial priorities. And yes, that becomes a line item in the budget. And once that's gone, you've freed up resources to some of the things that are probably more important to you.
Rachel, what are your thoughts? Let's bring you in here.
I think Stuart made so many great points there. The only things that I would add to there is we find that automation can really help. We know just in life, period, that it's easier to stick to a plan when it's on autopilot. And so think about applying that same concept to your savings and your debt pay down. Think about splitting your contributions and payments so you're chipping away at both. So for instance, you could set an auto payment from your checking account to the credit card company for those debt payments. Allocate portions of your paycheck going into different accounts, each assigned to different goals. And finally, celebrate debt milestones the same that you would a savings milestone, because it's progress either way. And it's really important to maintain momentum that you recognize this progress. And then the celebration of that debt-free milestone is a big part of it. And people
scream about it.
Yes.
Literally scream about the fact that they are now debt-free, because it is such an emotional and exciting milestone.
Rachel, I'm glad you brought up automation, because that was a light bulb moment for me when I was reflecting on savings, in that so much of my savings for retirement is automated, exactly what you're talking about. It gets taken out of my paycheck and it goes into my employer-sponsored retirement plan, which is a 401k. So that automation really is helpful. And don't forget that you're doing it. To your point on celebration, that's cause for a mini celebration.
Absolutely. The one thing I would also add, over the years, we've really learned by studying retirement behavior that set it and forget it is not necessarily the best policy. You want to set it and get the ball rolling. But then over time, as you have the opportunity, also look to increasing your savings. So one of the things we've also found has been really successful is an automatic increase that can be set once a year that might align with when people might be likely to be receiving an increase.
That automatic increase on the 401k can be really powerful. So for our listeners, maybe take out a Post-it note. I'm a self-described Post-it queen. And whenever I hear something that is really striking, or I think I should revisit that, take out the Post-it. I think we're all going to make a mental Post-it right now. Check on my auto increase for my 401k plan.
And I would say look not only at increasing it, but think about how much you can increase it by. Because if you do it 1% as an example, it might take you 10 years to get to a recommended savings level. If you can afford to do 2% at a time, that can get you to those savings goals that much more quickly. So yes, to your point, and explore what your options might be when you get there.
Got it. So Rachel, one of the words you used at the beginning of our discussion today was overwhelming. And I want to explore that some more. Can you help us think, what is the first step to prioritizing your goals so that it doesn't feel quite so overwhelming?
I think the first thing is to start by looking honestly at your budget. And a helpful framework that we talk about is aspiring to this 50-30-20 rule. So 50% for necessities, 30% for discretionary spending, and at least 20% for savings and investment. And as Stuart has already shared, many people may not be able to achieve that framework out of the gate when people are spending so much on housing and transportation. So think about it as a rule of thumb and maybe an aspiration. And understanding where you are today is a good first step towards that. Second piece would be, even before you get to actually saving and moving money into different accounts, start by tracking how you're actually spending your money today. So not just how you're thinking about spending it, but as Stuart shared with us from his teaching experience, if tracking everything feels overwhelming, just start with one or two categories, because it can be really illuminating to understand where your money's going and how that aligns with the things that are important to you. The third thing I would say is, we know that many people feel like they can't afford to save, and it's a real concern. And the good news is, you don't have to do everything at once.
Oh boy, that's another big post-it for me. That one's very applicable. Thank you. I've heard both of you reference an emergency fund a few times. And this might be an obvious question, but I feel like as the host, it's my job to ask the obvious question, right? What is an emergency fund? Where does it live? Is it my checking account? What is it?
Sometimes it's helpful to think of an emergency fund as the extra money you know you're going to need, but you don't know yet what you're going to need it for. So the easy example is car repairs. You know you're going to have to repair your car, so work that into your budget. But sometimes there might be a bigger repair than you expected, or something happens to your house and you've got to suddenly come up with a fair amount of money to cover it. The big one is losing your job. So you still have all the expenses and suddenly your income stopped, and it's going to be a while before you can get a new job and get more income. So the emergency fund is there for that unknown expense. You've got to have it available immediately because you don't know when it's going to occur. So having it in something like a money market fund or a savings account is what makes sense for something like that. We talk about 3 to 6 months worth of expenses. It works out to about 20 to 30% of whatever your income is, if it's easier to do the math that way. And once you've got that emergency fund built up, whatever money was going into it, you can now redirect somewhere else until the emergency arrives. And then if it gets depleted, okay, we've got to make some sacrifices and changes and put the money back in the emergency fund.
Thank you.
And I would just add to that that we know that the existence of an emergency savings fund is incredibly powerful at enabling people to manage, continue to manage towards those other savings goals. Or when we look at retirement plan experience, we see a significant reduction in the amount of loans and hardship withdrawals that are taken from retirement plans. So having that money enables you to keep other goals on track.
The other benefit it has is emotional. I mean, emergency is something bad has just happened. A medical event, I've lost my job, something serious with the house or the car. So not only am I having to deal with that part of it, now if I also have to worry about, well, where am I going to get the money to take care of this emergency, that just makes it worse. But if you have the emergency fund in place, okay, that's at least one area that you don't have to focus on. You can take care of whatever the emergency is, and it makes people feel more confident. You know, if something happens, I'm prepared, at least financially.
What I'm hearing is that emergency is going to happen.
It's life.
Right. One way or another. And having that emergency fund set up might help you sleep better at night until it does happen. So Okay.
And then when it does happen, it's probably helping you sleep better then too, because you know you have the money.
Sleep and coffee, two big takeaways from today's discussion. Rachel, you mentioned retirement plans. I heard you say that. And I'm just wondering, how does the retirement plan fit into this conversation?
So I think that's really related to thinking about the goals that you were saving towards and where you should be investing in those. And depending on the goal that you're marching towards, there might be specific account types that make the best sense for allocating the money there. And retirement is an excellent example of that. So for retirement, there are employer-sponsored retirement plans. There are also individual retirement accounts that enable you to save both on a pre-tax basis as well as Roth or after-tax. And that idea of the account type matching the type of goal applies in other areas as well. For example, there are 529 plans for education, there are health savings account and flexible spending account for medical and dependent care expenses. And for pretty much everything else, there isn't necessarily a specific tax-advantaged account. You can use a high-yield savings account for safety and liquidity as an example for those short-term goals, and a general investing or taxable account for medium and longer-term goals.
So what I'm hearing from you, Rachel, is account first and then match the tax benefit to the goal and automate as much as you can.
Yeah, I think you summarized it great.
Okay. I do want to mention that we covered account diversification and retirement income planning last season, and something to look forward to. We'll be going even deeper later this season in our episode that's focused on 360 retirement tax planning. Very exciting. So I'm going to keep going with this idea of goals and account types. Now, can we talk about how we should think about short-term versus long-term, and why does that distinction matter?
It matters because your time frame, sometimes us financial planners will call it time horizon, helps you figure out how to invest the money that you've saved. So you've figured out how much you're putting away, you've picked the account it's going into, so perhaps a 401k or an IRA for retirement or a 529 plan for your children's education, but you still have to make the decision about what to invest it in. And a big driver, in addition to your risk tolerance and personal circumstances, is the time horizon of the goal that you have. So if it's for retirement and it's decades in the future, the price of everything will be higher, then potentially investing in stocks makes more sense for that because you have all those decades to ride out any short-term fluctuations in the market. So you'll experience, in all likelihood, down years, maybe more than a couple of years, up years over that time period. So expect that. But you're not using your money for potentially 30 years. If you're saving for your kids' college education, if you start when they're born, potentially 18 years, still a long time horizon. So those would be for longer term goals. If we move back a bit into medium term goals, so you're saving for a down payment on a house in 5 to 7 years, well, the stock market volatility is going to potentially work against you, and you don't want to show up having to put that down payment down and you have less money than you started with. So for a medium-term goal, you're going to want to have more in short-term investments and less in the stock market, potentially just a little bit in the stock market. And lastly, for short-term goals, so you're building up your emergency fund, it's something you plan to spend the next 1 to 3 years, nothing in the stock market, it's what we've talked about before. Savings accounts, maybe CDs, conservative bond funds. You don't necessarily need a lot of growth that the stock market potentially could give you, but with the variability in the return, that doesn't make sense. So you want to make sure that your investments are going to stay steady, and if you need that emergency fund tomorrow, it's available. So you're essentially matching the time horizon to the amount of money you have in stocks. And you can even choose investments that do that for you. So let me give you an example, especially with long-term goals, how this might work out. Let's say I want to have $1.5 million for retirement, and I picked that number just to make the math easy. I want to have $1.5 million for retirement in 30 years. Now, one approach is I save $50,000 a year in cash. And when I say cash, I mean I'm burying this in my backyard.
Okay. So there's where do you live, Stuart?
There's no return at all. So if I'm getting no return, I have to save $50,000 a year. But if I invest and earn around 8% annually, I only need to save a little over $12,000 a year. Because over 30 years, that potential growth makes up a lot of what I want to spend at the other end. So I either save $50,000 a year or a little over $12,000 a year. That's a huge difference, and why thinking about your time horizon and how it connects to how you're investing your money makes so much sense.
Perfect. So we've talked a lot about saving, and I think we all agree it's something that people want to do. They know they need to do it. Can we walk through some maybe best practices to stay motivated? And do you have any ideas for adjustments people might consider making as their life changes, or particularly relevant these days as the market changes, the market environment?
Yeah, the first thing I'd like to share is that we have seen that people are more likely to get started and to stick with it when saving feels approachable and rewarding. And there are many planning tools that use the same types of techniques that keep us engaged online to specifically help with money. So they include gamification features like progress bars or peer comparison challenges and timely nudges. And I would suggest taking advantage of those types of tools that make it feel easy and accessible, both to get started, but also really importantly, to keep going. And a big part of sustaining that momentum and keeping going is breaking down what can otherwise feel like an insurmountable savings goal into really manageable steps. And we do this in other aspects of our life, like training for a marathon or building flexibility through a stretching routine. We know that progress comes in stages, and recognizing those small improvements between those stages keeps us motivated. And we should be celebrating these intermediate milestones.
And I, of course, will address the market's move part of that question. You knew that was coming. So rebalancing your portfolio to stay aligned with your plan is good. Changing your plan just because the market went up or down is market timing. And that's a bad idea. So your plan should be driven by your goals and timelines, not headlines. Make sure you're sticking with your plan and you're making changes because of your plan. Don't be making changes because
of the screaming headlines, which are so relevant today. It's hard to look at the news without feeling like, oh my goodness, I'm being yelled at.
To your point, Jessica, unfortunately, there are a lot of people whose investment strategy I call EBGYOT.
Oh my, I'm intrigued.
Yeah, it stands for eight bald guys yelling on TV.
Oh.
Because as you pointed out, they're always yelling. Now, they might not always be a guy, they might not always be bald, but they are always yelling.
Always yelling.
And it makes you feel like you're supposed to do something. But
yes.
They don't know your plan. They don't know your goals. They don't know what account you've used. They don't know what your investment strategy is. So changing what you're doing because, and since it's a podcast, I'll just be right up front about it. I'm a bald guy.
Well, thank you for saying that so I didn't have to say it, Stuart.
You know, that's how it goes. I try not to yell. But just because somebody is yelling about something, they don't know anything about you. So put the plan together, stick with the plan.
Stick with the plan. I like that.
One of the things you should be doing is adjusting your percentage in stocks as your timeline shrinks. So as your child, for example, gets closer to college, you'll want to move from growth-oriented investments like stocks into more conservative, capital-preserving options. You don't want that volatility. And you might have chosen investments that do that automatically, like an enrollment-based portfolio for college or a target date solution for retirement. It means you don't have to make those changes manually. It goes back to Rachel's point about automation. Now, you're going to want to make sure you rebalance at least annually to avoid your portfolio, your mix of stocks and bonds, drifting away from where it needs to be based on your time horizon. Again, if you're in an option that auto rebalances, that work is happening for you. And also, update your contributions as life changes. If your income rises or expenses fall, that gives you the opportunity to redirect that extra money towards what you've decided are those more important goals. It doesn't have to be a big adjustment. Maybe you want to replace your car a little earlier so you plan a smaller, cheaper vacation that year. We're all constantly adapting. The key is being thoughtful about what's most important to you and making those kinds of trade-offs. And lastly, pair that automation with progress tracking. We've talked a lot about how the tools can offer personalized projections, interactive dashboards, the opportunity to celebrate these kinds of things. All of that helps you feel confident about what you've put together and how it's working.
Well, I don't know about you, Stuart, Rachel, but I feel like we made savings fun today. And we certainly covered a lot of ground. So that brings me to my final question for both of you, which is, what final thoughts would you leave our listeners with? Let's start with you, Rachel.
Sure. I have two points that I would share as final thoughts. And the first of these is to leverage your resources. You do not have to go through this alone. We often hear that individuals look to their employers and the service providers that they work with to offer benefits programs for help. And many employers are providing access to solutions. So look there. You likely might find tools and education that will help you as you're thinking about putting together a personalized plan. And the second piece, and this might be the most important piece, is just to take that first step. So whether it's setting up an automatic transfer out of your account to start those savings, momentum starts small. It doesn't have to be a big one in terms of the amount that you're saving. The most important part is just to get started.
I love that. Take the first step. Stuart, how about you?
Well, first, I hope we've given you a three-step process to apply to any time you have a goal that you want to achieve. Prioritize it, match an account to it, and invest appropriately. So anytime something new comes in, you just put it through those three steps. And that will help you figure out how to adjust your plan, which is the second point. Revisit the strategy regularly. Life is going to change. Some goals will become less important. New goals will enter. Just keep doing that so you've taken the time to review and adjust. And lastly, most importantly, don't wait for the perfect plan. Start with what you know, refine as you go, and stay committed. Confidence comes from that consistent action.
Thank you so much, Stuart and Rachel. If I reflect on our conversation today, one of my key takeaways is that another way of defining savings is spending in the future. Spending in the future equals savings.
That's it. It's what you want in the future.
That's really helpful, and it's a different way of thinking about it, which I love. So again, I'm Jessica Sclafani. Thank you for listening. Please tune in to our next episode when we'll be discussing special considerations for women and Social Security. And if you like this podcast, and I know you do, please rate us and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, the numbers matter, but so does knowing you have the freedom to live with purpose and peace of mind.
T. Rowe Price. Retire with confidence. This episode of Confident Conversations on Retirement is provided for general and educational purposes only and is not intended to provide legal, tax, or investment advice. This podcast does not provide recommendations concerning investments, investment strategies, or account types. It is not individualized to the needs of any specific investor and not intended to suggest any particular investment action is appropriate for you, nor is it intended to serve as the primary basis for investment decision-making. Investors will need to consider their own circumstances before making an investment decision. All investments involve risk, including possible loss of principal. The views contained herein are as of the date noted on the material and are subject to change without notice. These views may differ from those of other T. Rowe Price Group companies and or associates. Copyright 2025, T. Rowe Price. All rights reserved. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence. Retire with confidence. The Bighorn Sheep Design and Confident Conversations, collectively and or apart, are trademarks of T. Rowe Price Group, Inc. All rights reserved. T. Rowe Price Investment Services, Incorporated Distributor. T. Rowe Price Associates, Incorporated Investment Advisor.